Hello and welcome. You're tuned into the best in true crime talk radio. This is True Crime Tuesday. I'm your host, Dave Schrader, along with me, Tim Dennis. Dumb crime, stupid criminals a little later. But Tim.
Yes.
You know, I'm always looking for interesting cases to represent on the show. And then once I kind of find an interesting case, the jumping off point is finding an author or a documentarian or somebody that has insight on the case.
Mm-hmm.
And is want them to happen from time to time. It's hard to find those people, or you find out that the original author and researcher is passed on or unavailable period to do interviews anymore. So it leaves me in a bit of a quandary. Luckily, at our disposal for the last decade or so here, we have had one of the best resources in the marketplace. Whenever there is a case I want to know about, I set this guy loose. He learns everything he can on it so he can come in and talk to us about this. And this is the case that we're going to discuss today. It's a small town mystery and a small town history of violence that led to a town that got away with murder. And it is a really weird case of bully and self-justice and how far a community will go to protect themselves. So when we need somebody to chime in and help us out, Tim, there's only one name we can call on.
William Shatner.
No, he was too busy for us, Tim. Okay. We had to go the next level down, but still a great find nonetheless. Mark Anthony is back.
Oh.
He is an Oxford-educated trial attorney, licensed to practice law in Florida, Washington, D.C., and before the United States Supreme Court. He appears regularly on television as a legal analyst, also a psychic medium and expert on the paranormal, after-death communication and near-death experiences. He is here today to discuss with us the town that got away with murder. Mark, it's great to have you back with us.
Thanks, Dave. Thanks, Tim. It's always fun working with you guys.
Now, had you heard of this story before I brought it to your attention and asked you to dig into this?
Well, you know, the funny thing is yes and no, because I've always heard Skidmore. Oh, you don't want to get stuck in Skidmore. And then when you said, hey, Mark, would you look into this? And I found out that Skidmore is this little town in Missouri of, you know, roughly 400 people or so with a pretty dark and grisly history. I mean, Dave, this town could be the setting for a Stephen King novel or a Twilight Zone episode. So many bizarre things have happened here.
Really? All right. Well, like what type of weird things have happened? Maybe that's kind of a good setting to talk about this town and its history before we get into the specifics of the case.
Yeah. The most famous case is the one we're going to talk about. But for a town of roughly 400 people, it seems like it just has this unbelievably gruesome history of violence. And I mean, there was a case there where a pregnant woman, okay, her name was Bobby Jo Stinnett. She was 8 months pregnant, and for whatever reason, she got into some type of altercation with this woman named Lisa Montgomery, who went into Bobby Jo's house, strangled her with a rope, and then cut the baby out of her womb with a kitchen knife. Now, that's horrible enough as it is. I mean, if there's one positive thing, the baby survived, who's now actually an adult. And this woman was, she pled not guilty, but they're trying to say that she's, not guilty by reason of insanity. But then as recently as 2001, this 20-year-old young man, Branson Perry, disappeared from his house. And he hasn't been seen from since. But then a former minister, a guy by the name of Jack Wayne Rogers, was sentenced to 30 years for pornography charges and for cutting off another man's genitalia. Okay. So authorities have been searching Rogers' home looking for some evidence that would implicate him in Perry's death. And of course, he's denied it. So it's just like all these creepy things happen. We're talking 400 people here. You know, I mean, this is a small town. And they're like, oh, well, you know, these things happen everywhere. Well, I live in a small town. And yeah, we have some things happen now again. But we're talking, I mean, cutting a baby out of a womb after you strangle the mother, another minister cutting off men's genitals, young men just disappearing, and nobody seems to know anything.
So, I mean, how far back are we going, though? I mean, are we talking this is going back into the 1800s and settler times that there's been just a string of strange activity?
Oh, no. These things that happened with Bobby Joe, we're talking 2005. And then with the young guy, Branson Perry, that disappeared, we're talking 2001. So, and then the case that we're going to be talking about goes to the 1980s. So let's say that pretty much for at least the past 40 to 50 years, there have been these incredible outbreaks of brutal homicides in this town, and nobody seems to be able to figure out why this is.
All right. Now, in a town, 440 people, right? It does seem, you know, small town, you kind of get this middle America Mayberry feel from a town that small. And to have that high levels of murder, mayhem, and mystery, is this just like a criminal town loaded with derelicts? I mean, what exactly do we know about it?
It, you know, from all accounts, it is exactly a small Midwestern town. It's in northwest Missouri. The people there, for the most part, either work in factories or in agriculture, and they seem to be basically good, decent, hardworking Midwestern American citizens. I mean, it's not like they've uncovered horrible cults and white supremacists or some other type of extremist organization. These are people, for the most part, I would say middle to lower middle class on the socioeconomic income level, maybe even poor people, but nothing that would make them stand apart or be different from other small towns throughout the whole country that would certainly generate this type of vitriolic violence.
Do you think that there's really nothing different about this town than there is any other town, but because it is smaller, it makes it seem more horrific?
Well, that's certainly the take of psychologists who've looked at this. They said that in small towns, it seems to be kind of amplified, you know, because they look at it as a sort of an oasis in the middle of the desert, sort of an island set by itself where all these type of things are sort of magnified. Because if you look at a big city like Chicago or New Orleans or New York City, I mean, there's nothing unusual about murders. I mean, they happen all the time. But in small towns, it seems to be amplified for some reason. But on the other hand, in a small town, everybody knows each other. A lot of people are related to each other. So they develop an almost tribal mentality. It's us as the town against the rest of the world. And generally, in these small towns, people not only stick together, but they kind of look out for each other. I mean, it doesn't mean everybody always gets along, but for the most part, they're going to be more cohesive than, let's say, somebody that lives in an apartment building in Manhattan, and maybe you see your neighbors, but you never really talk to them. You know, people in larger cities tend to be less cohesive as a group than people in small towns.
All right. Now, this crime that I was interested in most before I knew that there was so many other bizarre things taking place in this town, this town that dealt with a bully. Maybe we can jump back in at this point now and you can introduce us to Ken Rex McElroy. Is that how you say it?
That is. Yeah, Ken McElroy, he was born in 1934 and into a very poor family of 16 children, and he was the second to the last.
16 children?
16 children, and his father was a sharecropper. So these were very poor people, which, you know, doesn't make anyone bad. It just makes them poor. He dropped out of school at an early age, and depending on who you read, some say fifth grade, some say eighth grade, but essentially he was illiterate. Now, the fascinating thing, the thing that set up a red flag for me, Dave, is in my research of Ken McElroy, it indicates that as a child, he fell from a hay wagon and sustained a severe head injury so that a steel plate had to be implanted in his head. So this would then qualify him and I used to be when I was practicing law full time, because now I'm working as a medium full time and as a commentator on shows like this one. I did a lot of work with head injury cases. And so McElroy fits the definition of the mild to moderate head injury. Now, with head injury, normally when you think about it, you think of somebody who's severely brain damaged who then has motor function, speech problems, cognitive deficits. But the mild to moderate head injury, it puts people in a different behavior. They get very forgetful. For example, let's say – they'll pour themselves a glass of milk, put it on the counter, and then go in another room and then come back and see the milk there and say, who put that there? And then begin, because they forgot about it, their short-term memory is impaired. Then the paranoia sets in that there's somebody in this house. Also, it seems to the mild to moderate head injury brings down their filters. In other words, their frustration for tolerance gets lower, impulsive behaviors increase. So now we have a kid from a difficult home environment who is most likely got the mild to moderate brain injury, and then he begins acting out on impulse, aggression, rage, frustration. And as things evolved, he became a one-man crime wave in this small town.
And, you know, again, hearing this isn't something new, right? I mean, it's interesting how many people, and which you're finding out with, what do they call it, CTE, with these brain injuries,
right?
How it puts people into a quicker state of rage, and almost an inability to control their anger.
Well, exactly. The impulse control. And in the criminal justice system and in my personal injury practice, you saw this all the time. People with impulse control issues. Well, McElroy started basically molesting young girls, stole anything he wanted, got in fights. He was a kind of a physically big, stocky guy. He was a bully and a brute. He shoved people around, intimidated people. He fathered over a dozen children himself. And he was always getting arrested for felonies, and apparently he had a really good lawyer, this guy named Richard McFadden, who just recently retired, and he's in his late 80s. And McFadden seemed to get him out of everything. McElroy was arrested for one violent crime, one crime of theft, one charge after the other. Like I said, he was molesting young girls. His last victim, if you will, was a 12-year-old girl named Trina. And not only did he start having sex with this 12-year-old girl, he wanted her to be his wife. And she got so afraid of him, Dave, that she escaped and she went back to her parents' house. Well, McElroy went over there and demanded her release. When her father said no, he shot their family dog, and then he lit their house on fire. Okay.
Jeez.
Yeah. So he said he'd come back and kill them. So she went back to him, and then he realized that if he forced her to marry him, then she would not be able to testify against him in trial. Now, I don't know. Normally, with the spousal immunity privilege, meaning one spouse cannot testify against the other, it has to be in the context of an actual marriage. So for all the things that he did and he did to her, and criminal things that occurred before they actually got married, would still be admissible. Be that as it may, he got out of this again. And by the time she was 14, Trina McElroy then had a little girl.
Wait, one second. Let me ask. So this guy is raping a 12-year-old.
Right.
He shoots the family dog, starts a fire, and doesn't go to jail. Are they just taking pity on somebody they think is brain damaged?
That's very possible. Because I've been researching this, and it just seemed like one charge after the other slipped through the justice system's fingers. But then I started to see a pattern, Dave. I think that anybody that wanted to testify against him was terrified to do so, because charges seemed to get dropped right and left. In other words, it's a small town. Everybody knows everybody. McElroy beats up somebody or starts a fire. There's witnesses. He knows who they are, and they know that he knows, and they know that he's going to come and beat them up or kill them. So I think that basically he was not only a one-man crime wave, he was a one-man terror network, for lack of a better term. People were horrified, terrified of this man. And he used to hang out at this bar, the D&G Tavern, get drunk. If you looked at him the wrong way, you ended up getting a broken jaw. So no matter what, nothing seemed to deter or stop this guy until his child with his now 14-year-old wife, Trina, at the age of 14, had a little girl. And the little girl, they were in a general store, and she stole a candy bar. Now, the store owner – and it's funny because, like, you ever watch this old reruns of, like, the Waltons? Remember the general store that they used to go to on Walton's Mountain?
Well, sure.
Skidmore is sort of like the Twilight version of Walton's Mountain, okay? So this little kid goes in and she grabs a candy bar, and the store owner says, hey, you got to pay for that. And McElroy pulls out a gun and shoots the 70-year-old store owner, Bo Bowenkamp, right in the neck, okay? And his wife, Lois, is like losing her mind. She, you know, of course, she calls for help. And Bo Bowenkamp actually survives. Well, this was the final straw, because not only did McElroy get arrested, but he actually went to trial and for the first time was convicted. But pending sentencing, the judge agrees to release him. Now, this is very, very suspicious, because why in the world would you release somebody with a long history of violence and who just committed, attempted murder on an elderly man? Was it some type of conspiracy? Was the judge being paid off? Was the prosecutor a weakling? Because the prosecutor in this area, his name was David Baird, and he took the post as prosecutor because he heard that nothing exciting ever happens in Nottoway County, Missouri. And then all of a sudden, he is presiding over a small jurisdiction with the biggest, baddest, nastiest guy imaginable. And apparently, in his early years as a prosecutor, from what I can see, Baird used to back down a bit. And I think that the defense attorney, Richard McFadden, used to strong arm him and probably was real buddy-buddy with the judge. And so the judge agrees to release McElroy until he can be sentenced. Well,
McElroy, to release a guy who is obviously a danger to the entire town. Now, I know where this is all going to go, but it just seems so insane from the onset that they would even consider doing this.
Well, look at the Jerry Epstein. Was it Epstein case? The one going on now, the billionaire who was involved in the child sex trafficking and all of that. We're seeing this in national news now, and this is not an unheard of thing in the legal system, but this is also a problem in the legal system. Now, let's say that it was a nonviolent crime, you know, where, I don't know, maybe it was just this theft of the candy bar or theft of some money. I can see releasing somebody, but when somebody takes a gun and shoots somebody else, that means they are prone to violence. So the judge agrees to release pending sentencing. Well, McElroy starts getting drunk and runs his mouth in the local bar that he is going to kill Bo Bowenkamp and all the witnesses that testified against him. And the townspeople are terrified, and they sought help. They all got together, and the townspeople wrote letters to the governor of Missouri, to the attorney general, to the state legislature. They said they were living in fear of their lives and they wanted to see some type of justice. Nobody responded. And meanwhile, McElroy, now he starts getting wind of this and he's really torqued up. So he shows up at the good old D&G Tavern with an M1 rifle with a bayonet on it. All right, I mean, this is a weapon of war. And now this violated his terms of release pending appeal. So he gets arrested, okay? And he's before the judge again. And, you know, when you're out on appeal, out on early release pending appeal because of a weapons charge, and then you get arrested for carrying another firearm, you really should be held without bond. But somehow or other, Richard McFadden, McElroy's attorney, postponed the appeal hearing and once again got him early release pending the appeal. And the prosecutor did not object. And this is the problem that I really have. All of this could have been avoided if they would have had a competent prosecutor. And I'm going on record and saying David A. Baird was negligent and derelict in his obligation to protect the people of the community in his capacity as a prosecutor. So now McElroy's out. And he is fuming mad and vowing bloodlust and revenge.
Holy cow. How does a guy that seems so unskilled at what he does hold that position? Again, is it because it's small town politics?
It could be small town politics. It could be that people were so afraid of him. But the thing is, judges and prosecutors and police aren't supposed to be intimidated by community members. Could it have been some type of corruption behind the scenes where his attorney, McFadden, was paying off the judge? Or was it just blatant incompetence by both the judge and by the prosecutor? I'm also seeing that it doesn't appear that there may have been a courthouse in this small town of Skidmore. They probably had to go to the county seat. So whereas people in Skidmore knew that McElroy was this one-man crime wave, meanwhile in the county seat where they have cases coming in from all over the county, the judges, you know, may just be looking as, whatever, next, call your next case, because, you know, judges get into a routine mindset, and prosecutors, they got boxes of cases, and they're just moving it along, and this fell through the cracks. And I'm not making excuses for the system. None of that's supposed to happen. You're supposed to have people there dedicated to doing their jobs, and clearly nobody did. So meanwhile, the townspeople are terrified, Dave. They are just in absolute terror that McElroy is going to start exacting revenge and killing them. So on July 10th of 1981, the townspeople gathered at the Legion Hall. And they started to discuss what to do about McElroy when they felt that their lives were in danger and that no one in the government, no one in law enforcement is going to protect them.
So there's this kind of militia mentality starting to build.
Oh, you betcha. Now, what's interesting, I want to digress just for a moment, and let's talk about where we are. We're in Skidmore. It's an agricultural town, a little bit of industry maybe, and it grew up in the frontier days. And back in the 1800s, there was a concept known as frontier justice.
And just to clear up too, this is Skidmore, Missouri, just so people know where we're at, right?
Right. So we're basically smack in the middle of the U.S. in a fairly isolated area. And frontier justice is where townspeople, in the absence of a legal system, will execute people like cattle rustlers and other criminals because they feel that there is no legal system other than them. And this has also been called as vigilante justice. And a vigilante justice is when a single person or a group of people claim to enforce the law but lack the legal authority to do so. Now, in recent years, I mean, Clint Eastwood made a career out of movies. The Dirty Harry movies were vigilante justice, because think of a mother who shoots someone who's molesting her child, okay, or has molested her child, and the mother goes in and shoots them. I've seen cases where people who do that walk scot-free because the jury is like, well, that guy needed killing, okay? And then you have the lynch mob mentality, and that's where people want to kill someone without a trial because they perceive them as some sort of a threat. Now, mob mentality, which then leads to vigilante justice, frontier justice, is a very real thing. but it's also seen from a psychological standpoint, Dave, as herd mentality. In other words, a group of people flock together because they're being influenced by their peers, and they also believe in the safety in numbers concept. So what was going on here may also be, if you want to further examine the psychological profile of what was happening to the town as a group, there's a concept known as de-individuation. And de-individuation is a term used to explain mob mentality and violence. When people are part of a group, they experience de-individuation, which means a loss of self-awareness. So instead of thinking of themselves as an individual, they think of themselves as part of a larger whole of a group. And as such, as part of a larger group, they believe they are not, nor should they be, held responsible for the violent behavior when part of that mob resorts to violence. In other words, everyone was doing it, so it really wasn't my fault.
Right. So it was, hey, it's kind of like, you know, are you really speeding when everybody else on the highway is doing the same speed as you? It's just going with the flow of traffic.
Bingo. I think, you know, Dave, I think that's probably one of the best examples of de-individuation I've ever heard. Well, everyone else was doing it. Yeah, the speed limit sign says 55, but we're all going 80 because everyone's doing it. You know, and it's funny because, you know, I remember my parents saying this to me when I was a kid. Well, you know, everyone in high school is doing it. Well, Mark, if everyone in high school jumped off a cliff, would you jump off a cliff? You know, and it's funny because, you know, you hear things like that and then you stop and think about it. And it's like, yeah, that's exactly it. So let's warp back in time now to July 10th, 1981. Here you have this guy with a long history of stealing livestock, beating people to a pulp, shooting people, stealing, raping children, threatening people for testifying against him, and lighting houses on fire, okay? You've got this horrible person. The townspeople decided that it was up to them to launch a preemptive strike, okay, out of necessity to protect themselves. So McElroy is sitting in his truck with his wife Trina out in front of the D&G tavern on the main street there in Skidmore in front of the entire town, and all of a sudden two men approach the truck, one from behind and one in the front, and they open fire, and they fill that truck with rounds and rounds of ammunition. They just unload on it, and they blow McElroy into the next life. And no one shot Trina, okay? She was clearly not the target. And what's fascinating is it took hours for the police to get there. And when they did, they found several casings from two different types of weapons, a 22 caliber Magnum and an 8mm Mauser. Now, we can talk about those in a minute. And Trina is screaming that she knew who one of the shooters was, but nobody in the town saw anything. And when the police started asking, well, did you see anything? No, didn't see anything. Well, I heard something. Oh, yeah, we're all afraid, so we ran inside. Everybody in the town said, we saw nothing, we know nothing, and to this day, not one person from that town has ever come forward and ever admitted they knew anything about the two men who gunned down Ken McElroy.
That's unbelievable. Now, you know, there are different angles to this story that can puzzle me. Here's the first one. If this guy's able to get off so easily for so many of these crimes, as the father of the 12-year-old daughter whose dog has been shot, house has been lit on fire, and basically my daughter's been absconded with, why did this father not put a bullet in this jackass's head to begin with? Because he, of anybody, has enough provocation to get away with this and go to court and say, listen, this guy was a threat to me, the life of my daughter and my home, my family. This isn't justice being meted out. It's protection. Why didn't the father step up?
Well, maybe he did. You know, that's something we don't know. And yeah, why didn't the father step up? I mean, Dave, you're a father. If someone grabbed your 12-year-old daughter and said he was, you know, was going to start raping her, would you just stand there and take it? Of course not.
That guy would have vanished the first time I even heard that he was looking at my daughter cross-eyed.
Exactly. But for whatever reason, these people kept putting up with this. You know, and it may have been because he was just sort of the rotten kid in the town, and he grew up, oh, well, that's just Ken. I don't mean to do any accents because it's Midwestern. Well, that's just Ken. That's what he does, okay? And maybe they fell into a pattern of behavior where they were enabling and allowing this to go on. That coupled with an ineffective legal system. There was like one police officer said he was the only person that McElroy was afraid of. And he said that basically the cop said, oh, well, this is what happened. We couldn't find any witnesses. I found a quote from the postmaster, Jim Hartman. He said, I can't think of anyone who'd seen it, meaning the shooting, feel any different than you would about the people who invented penicillin. Nobody tried to hang them for finding a way to kill a germ.
Wow.
That's pretty intense. Now, the weapons that were used, a 22 caliber Magnum and an 8mm Mauser. Okay, let's start with the 8mm Mauser. Was a World War II era German rifle. Okay, so one of the guys used a World War II German rifle on this guy. The other one was a 22 caliber Magnum. Now, what was so fascinating about that? The 22 caliber Magnum, it uses the most common ammunition in the world, which can be used in rifles, revolvers, machine guns, and semi-automatic pistols. And if it's used in a rifle, which it may have been here because they've never – I haven't seen any reports that say it didn't. It could take down a bear. Okay, so between a weapon that was used on the Russian front by Germans and a 22 caliber Magnum, McElroy had no chance. And they also were very clear not to hurt Trina, but to get rid of McElroy once and for all.
Now, you said that Trina said she recognized one of the shooters, correct?
Yes.
Did she name the person?
She did. Trina claimed she knew one of the shooters, but with nobody to corroborate her claim, he couldn't be indicted. Now, I have a real hard time with that one, because what if someone comes in your house and stabs you, and you're the only witness, and you say, well, it was, you know, Jack Smith who lives down the street, okay? And then you go to Jack Smith's house, and you find, you know, whatever evidence to connect him to it. So was this because the prosecution finally had enough? I don't think so, because the prosecutor, what was the name, David Baer, just recently retired and said that was the most frustrating situation, never having anyone cooperate. I just think the guy was, just a lousy lawyer. That's my opinion. Everything I've read and seen about him shows this is not exactly a Johnny Cochran or a Clarence Darrow. So I think he was ineffective. I also think that the local police, for all we know, it could have been police officers that did this on behalf of the town, because everybody who was anybody was in on that meeting on July 10th at the Legion Hall. The whole town pretty much was there about what they're going to do about this. And clearly there was marching orders or consensus, or everybody swore, I saw nothing, I heard nothing. I mean, everybody said they heard something, but gee, they didn't see what happened. And oh, we ran for cover. We didn't know what was going on. And it was kind of like on what was that old show, Hogan's Heroes, when Sergeant Schultz, I see nothing, I hear nothing, I know nothing. Okay. The entire town did that. So this, to me, was a conspiracy to commit premeditated first-degree murder. Now, there's another fascinating component to this, if we're psychologically analyzing the town, is Schadenfreude. And we've heard that term a lot over maybe the past 20, 30 years. And Schadenfreude is a German word, but it means the sense of pleasure people derive from the misfortune of others. You see this a lot when, let's say, notoriously famous or wealthy people take a fall. I think one of the best examples of that may have been like Leona Helmsley. She was the extremely wealthy, I guess, billionaireess in New York City, owned the Empire State Building, and basically she used to insult and humiliate people, and then she got arrested and for income tax evasion, and a lot of people were happy about that. You may want to see like someone like Osama bin Laden getting shot in the head by the Navy SEALs. Sorry, I'm a little schadenfreude on that one too. But schadenfreude also involves three different components: envy, deservingness, and a social identity, which focuses on justice. The envy theory is when people perceive somebody that they envy. Okay, and let's take this in the context of the town. Maybe the people were envious of McElroy, although they were fearful of him because he was larger than life. He was powerful. He was dangerous. He was something that no matter how you confronted him, you were always vanquished. And right, people like it when somebody in that position gets knocked down a peg. Deservingness. That's the feeling that, well, they got what they was coming to, what was coming to them. Okay, I think that one kind of goes without saying here. But then there's the justice component of schadenfreude. And normally it's the us versus them scenario. And that's why generally small towns stick together. But this wasn't us versus them. It was us versus him. McElroy was a one-man crime wave, and the group, the rest of the town, bonded in the face of this adversity and felt they had no other choice than to take justice into their own hands. So I think schadenfreude basically explains what's going on here, and that this town reverted into vigilante and frontier justice, essentially became a lynch mob because they felt that they had to take the law into their own hands because our legal system wasn't protecting them. And in so doing, there was de-individuation because they acted as a group rather than a individuals who were responsible for their own actions.
But wasn't that, when you look back, the movie The Accused with Jodie Foster that came out based on a real case where it was like a gang rape that took place in a bar, and everybody got in on it. It became this weird tribal mentality, and one after another of the bar patrons violated her, and everybody was held accountable for their actions. You know, even the people that did not stop the people that were taking, you know, taking advantage of the situations. There was a pretty explosive version of the story where it played the other way, where everyone kind of ended up being found guilty or found, you know, I can't think of the correct word at this moment, but complicit in what was going on. And, you know, you understand in this case almost to a degree when somebody's doing what he's doing and getting away with it, that, you know, people come together, they're going to make this swift decision and it's going to go down and there's nothing you can do about it. And you basically have to agree everybody's going to remain silent, because even if you come to a deathbed confession, there's probably somebody still alive that was complicit in this act and is going to end up paying for it in the long run. So it's going to have to be a blanket silent statement across the board for what happened during this crime. But in the case of the accused, everybody ended up, you know, paying their dues. How is it that the people that we know were a part of that town meeting weren't found somewhat guilty
culpable
for inciting? Yeah, culpable for inciting.
That is the question. And basically, when questioned by the police, people may have said, well, I was there, but I didn't agree to anything. And so the people, I mean, for a town that, you know, forgive this if residents of Skidmore are listening, for a town that does not appear to be one of the intellectual epicenters of planet Earth, they're about as clever as it can be, because we literally had a shooting in broad daylight. There are piles of casings, yet nobody saw anything. Nobody's able to give evidence. Nobody is able to or willing to provide the police with anything. And yes, maybe everybody in that town, that Legion Hall, was part of a conspiracy, but unless somebody admits to it, you can't just in America round up a whole town and convict them. Now, something like that very well could happen in a place like Iran or Saudi Arabia or possibly Russia, but that certainly doesn't happen in the United States, nor should it. And this is a highly, highly unusual situation, because normally with 400 people, there's usually a blabbermouth in there somewhere, but here there wasn't.
All right. Now, once this takes place, how hard and deep did they probe into this investigation? Was it something that they kind of wrapped up within a week, or do they consider it still an ongoing situation that they are investigating?
It's still a cold case, and it's still an open file. There's no statute of limitations on a murder charge in Missouri, and as far as I know, in all 50 states. And once the shroud, Cheryl Houston, who had a father who'd been shot by McElroy and watched the killing of McElroy from her family's grocery store, said she didn't see anything. She said once the shroud of silence fell, there was going to be no one talking. So that was the mentality of the town over 30 years ago, and it still is. To this day, Dave, no one's talking about it. Now, let's suppose somebody did get arrested. What would their defense be? Now, naturally, if you look at it, they were launching a preemptive strike, okay? That's always a tough one. And you would be saying, out of necessity, we had to do this. But it's been very clear in our legal system since 1884 that the defense of necessity is not available to a charge of murder. And if I can digress for a moment, and plus since we're on Beyond the Darkness, I think the listeners will like this. The landmark case in this comes actually from the United Kingdom, from Great Britain. It's from Regina versus Dudley and Stevens. In other words, the Crown versus Dudley and Stevens. And what had happened is back in the 1880s, there was a shipwreck, and three men were adrift in a boat in the ocean following a storm. And they were there for 7 days without food and water. And the youngest of them, it was a 17-year-old boy, he went into a coma. And the other two were starving, so they slit his throat and then they ate him. So here we have cannibalism, and which from their perspective was a necessity. Here's the really ironic part. The very next day, they were rescued. A ship sighted them and rescued them. So here they are now on trial for murder and cannibalism. And this went up all the way to the House of Lords. And the issue was, in this context, whether there was any justification in killing the boy in order for the defendants to survive. Or could the defendants plead that the killing was necessary to save their own lives? And the House of Lords reasoned this. They said the defense of necessity is not available as a defense to murder. It is not possible to justify the killing of one individual in order to save the life of the other on the basis that the killing is necessary to do so. The interesting thing, though, is that they found there was one of the justices said that this lifeboat became a world unto itself, a microcosm. And that from their perspective, they created their own rules and their own rules of survival. And from this case over the last two centuries, there have has become the concept of justifiable homicide. Now, generally, let's get back to, all right, Dave, you're a father, and some creep is trying to rape your 12-year-old daughter or cause harm to one of your children, and you kill the guy. Okay, that's generally viewed it as justifiable homicide or self-defense. That's generally been viewed as justifiable homicide. But now we have a case where these two guys killed and ate somebody else because they felt it was justifiable and a necessity for them to live. So now we know that even if somebody in the town of Skidmore had been arrested and there was enough evidence to bring a charge, even if they raised the defense of necessity under Anglo-American jurisprudence, under United States law, that is not a defense that would be available to the killer.
All right. It's, boy, what a twisted plot on this entire thing. And you know, the sick thing is there's no clean hands. You want to say, you know, hey, kind of these guys were justified in what they did, because we want to see that there is justice in cases where we feel things are unjust and people are at risk. But you know, then you look at what, you know, taking the law in your own hands becomes a very dodgy situation, because if we're not clear in defining those lines and those laws, it becomes the Wild West again.
It does. I mean, how many times do you hear some murderer and you know that the guy did it? Okay, like let's say the guy that drove his car into the people in Charlotte. Okay, we know he did it. It's on film. They caught him red-handed. And you hear people say, just execute him. We don't even need a trial. Okay, the reason that we have a system of laws and a system of justice is to avoid reverting into frontier justice and this tribal herd mentality. Why? Because think about lynch mobs. Lynchings, which are a horrible, horrible stain and scar upon the history of the United States, where groups of extremists, white extremists, supremacists would lynch black men and black women who stood up to them or advocated rights. Okay, so from the supremacist standpoint, it was a necessity to get rid of these uppity people that were doing this, okay? And we certainly don't want to revert back to the Salem witch trials, where people who are different or unusual, or you just didn't like them, you start casting unprovable allegations against them. So even though you catch somebody like a Ted Bundy or John Wayne Gacy or one of these horrific criminals that do these things, we have a system of justice, because that is what distinguishes us from a lynch mentality and from a knee-jerk reaction and a sense of just of vengeance. Our criminal justice system can be summed up with three R's and a D: restraint, reformation, rehabilitation. Excuse me, revenge, restraint, or reformation, or deterrence. I'll take the D first. You create a crime that says that if you murder somebody, then you get put to death. The punishment is supposed to be so horrific that it deters you from doing it. Reformation or rehabilitation is the lofty goal. You know, that's why they call prisons correctional institutes. Look, I've been in criminal law a long time. Nobody got corrected that I ever represented or knew about that went to prison. In fact, they learned other skills in committing crimes when they came out of it. So while that's the lofty goal and certainly has a great objective, it really doesn't work for the most part. Restraint is the practicality. Get them out of society. Remove them. I hear a lot of countries and a lot of people say, well, the United States has more people incarcerated than any other country in the world. Well, yes, that may be true, but a lot of countries, particularly those in third world countries, and I've been to those countries, when you get arrested and go to prison, they don't feed you, so you die, okay? Unless your family feeds you, you die. And so the United States, we actually feed our prisoners. So I don't necessarily buy into that, we're terrible because we have more prisoners than anyone else. I think we need to revamp how we're convicting people and for what to get the nonviolent criminals out of there. And then the last objective is revenge. That's the most base level of the three R's and a D, but that's a visceral human desire to give someone who deserves it what's coming to them. And basically, if we operated on a revenge, vendetta form of justice, it's going to revert right back into what's happening or what happened in Skidmore. And that is the whole intent of our legal system, is due process, that people are innocent until proven guilty, and that we have a system and a procedure for the arrest, the charging, the conviction, and the sentencing of a person that's supposed to be rational and logical and to some extent humane. So that's why we have our system of justice. But then in a situation like this, when you de-evolve to that individuation, to that lynch mentality, this is what you end up with.
Are there still cases where this has taken place, these kind of vigilante justice, large group of people kind of pulling together? Is this probably one of the last modern day versions that you've been able to uncover?
I believe so. The whole concept of lynchings, I saw Oprah Winfrey do a whole special on this, and it was just sickening to see that how recent in our American history that people of African-American descent were being lynched because they were speaking out for civil rights, or they didn't want to conform. So to some extent, the backlash of all these things and the repercussions, it's like the ripple effect is still going on. But as far as something as extreme as Ken McElroy being murdered by two men, presumably in the town of Skidmore, being executed by the will of the town, I have not seen anything in recent history that parallels this, or the fact that 30 plus years later, nobody's still talking.
Do you feel if somebody get turned in at this point, would they face real time, or do you think that enough has de-evolved in the criminal justice system there that they wouldn't have enough information to put him away? Well, I guess that answer's already been done. She fingered one of the perpetrators, and her eyewitness account wasn't enough for them to do anything.
Right. And from what I was reading, rumors out of the town indicated that one of the shooters died recently, but they won't even say who. Also, Trina apparently moved, left Skidmore, never wants to come back, and refuses to take any interviews. So getting her to cooperate would be problematic at this point. And let's say, we had two guys that were 40. Okay, when they did this, I'm just rounding that off. All right, this is happened in 81, so it's almost 40 years ago. So these guys are most likely in their 80s or older. But even if they did get arrested, they would still be subjected to the full weight of the law. This would still be a premeditated first degree murder with no quote unquote provocation defense. Although certainly that would be argued and it would be delayed quite a bit. And then, of course, you would have to find a jury in Nottoway County that is going to convict that person. I mean, we had the situation recently, Dave, with the Navy SEAL who a seven-man military jury found Navy SEAL Chief Eddie Gallagher not guilty of murdering a wounded prisoner of war in Iraq. And from all accounts, the eyewitnesses said that he did this, although there was debate during trial. Things kind of turned around. And Gallagher was charged with premeditated murder of a male ISIS detainee. by stabbing him, and then obstruction of justice by attempting to get the men under his command to not testify. But when all the evidence came out, they found him not guilty of the murder and not guilty of the stabbing, not guilty of the shooting. They found him guilty of taking a photograph, I guess a selfie with a dead terrorist. So even to this day, just because somebody kills somebody else, that does not always a slam dunk at trial. There's always factors which are going to come up. I'm not justifying what Eddie Gallagher did. I'm simply reporting on it. I'm not justifying anything that the people in Skidmore did. My visceral, primeval aspect of me kind of feels that McElroy got what he deserved, but my higher functioning self said, well, that's why we do have a system of laws, because we don't want a mob deciding who lives, who dies, who's normal, who's not normal. That's why we have a system of justice.
Do you think there would be a case, let's say tomorrow, Mark Anthony comes forward and says, people come forward and say, Mark Anthony is one of the trigger men in this case, and you're put on trial. Is there any chance of counter suing the state, city, or even the county for, you know, putting me in the position as Mark Anthony? I'm in this position where I felt my only recourse of action to protect me and my fellow citizens was to eradicate the town of this man, of this menace, who has a laundry list of activity that he was not being held accountable for, from rape to theft to violence, shooting, stabbings, all of these different cases where, again, we have in this case, Mark, it seems to me that this would be something that could set a precedent for the way other cases are handled. If you push a person far enough to they feel threatened in their own community and that real justice is not forthcoming, at what point do you react and feel justified to do so?
Well, first off, to answer your question, could I bring a retaliatory lawsuit against the government agencies prosecuting me? No, you cannot under sovereign immunity. Okay, that means the government, the sovereign, is immune from lawsuits in that case. I mean, think of it. I mean, there'd be lawsuits filed right and left. But there are exceptions to sovereign immunity, like in cases of police brutality, where what the sovereign is doing against you is in and of itself illegal. But if I were, you know, in this hypothetical example, deemed to be one of the shooters, then there certainly would have to be enough evidence to reach a probable cause standard to bring me to trial, which then would indicate that sovereign immunity would shield the government from any retaliatory action on my part. But once again, there is nothing under our system of justice which legitimizes or justifies what the people of Skidmore did. They certainly had their own reasons. If you look at the dissent in...
Wait one second. How is it that the government is not held accountable and that they have this sovereign immunity when it is their job to protect and serve the people of their community? And they're not doing so. And it has been shown and proven time after time in court that this man was free and going on his way to just commit basically any crime he wants without any retaliatory presence.
Oh, I totally agree with you that the sovereign here was completely incompetent and negligent. But if we got rid of every incompetent person in government, I'm not so sure we'd have any people in government, really. But that's also something that the United States government, the Constitution, the founders of this country, and the people that have run it since then created the sovereign immunity to protect them from that very instance. But that's also a very fascinating discussion. What happens? Who do you call? Who do you call when no one's there to help you? I have a lot of African-American friends that say, well, who do we call? We call the police. So they come in and they start, well, you know, and they and that. And then I also know a lot of cops okay, talk about, you know, you walk into certain situations, you know it's going to be dangerous. But in this case, everything right across the board was broken. The system of justice was broken. The prosecutor was broken. The judge was broken. Certainly, McElroy was damaged goods. It got down to the people, from their perspective, saw as a matter of necessity and survival. They had to eliminate this threat once and for all. And it may not have been legal, but from their perspective, it had to happen.
What a remarkable tale. And just, you know, I mean, gives you pause to consider just what our legal system is. And I understand your points. Don't get me wrong. I'm not trying to.
I know. I mean, Dave, we've
raise
done
my
this
fist
long enough.
Higher.
That's your job. You know, you gotta, you know, challenge it, because it is. I mean, what do they say? There's an old saying, the law is an ass. Okay. They make everyone in court swear to tell the truth, except the lawyers. I mean, there's a lot that's wrong with our system. But I would rather deal with our broken system than be subjected to mob violence and herd mentality and individuation or Schadenfreude and Skidmore.
Huh. Well, you know, I wonder, do you ever see anybody coming forward with the truth of this case, or do you think that this will always be something that's just swept under the carpet and forgotten, especially if people do know about it? Because who wants to take that on? Who wants to admit that you might have been complicit in one way, shape, or another?
Well, in 2021, it'll be 40 years since this happened, so maybe the children of the people who were there might talk about it, but I have a very strong feeling that those who were actually part of that meeting and or, you know, could be one or both of the shooters, I don't think they're ever going to say a word. I think at this point it's sort of been swept under the rug there, and when outsiders come to ask about it, people probably politely smile and walk the other way.
Huh. All right. Fascinating stuff. Mark, thanks. You always do a great job for me in researching these cases that I want to cover that we have nobody to talk to, and really kind of getting a grip on the entire situation. So thank you for always doing that and helping us keep this story to light.
Well, it's my pleasure. And I just want to let the listeners know that I'm on the 2019 Frequency Tour. So I'll be all over the country this year. And if people want to find out about media appearances, and Dave and I are going to be back on the radio this week on Midnight in the Desert, but I'm going to be in Colorado at For Heaven's Sake and at the Arvada Center in the first 2 weeks in August. And then I'm off to Pennsylvania as the headliner at IANS, International Near-Death Studies 2019 conference, and I'll be speaking at the Ancient Mysteries Conference at the Edgar Cayce Center for Research and Enlightenment in Virginia Beach in October. And if anyone wants to find out about any of that and what I'm doing, kindly visit my website, which is evidenceofeternity.com. And Dave and Tim, thank you so much for having me on the show. I look forward to returning.
It's always a pleasure, buddy. And yeah, we'll have you on this Friday on Midnight in the Desert, which is 9 p.m. till midnight Pacific time. That is 11 p.m. till 2 a.m. Central time. For those of you on the East Coast, midnight till 3 a.m. You can find more information at midnightinthedesert.com. And we'll be talking more paranormal and metaphysical, of course, on that program. All right. The case files are open. Tim's been digging through, looking for the most bizarre and unusual stories to share this week. It's time for Dumb Crimes and Stupid Criminals.
It's Crayon News story time.
What happened with this dude, Christ Bearer? I heard he cut his penis off and then jumped off a balcony.
Suspect pulls gun from butt, shoots twice at Denver police.
What is your emergency?
I need help.
And what's the problem?
I'm too high.
You're too high?
Yeah.
Well, Tim, summer's here and the time is right for dancing in the streets and family vacations. Man, that is a memory we all have, being bottlenecked in a car for much too long with your parents chain smoking and not rolling down the windows, being forced to listen to soft rock on the radio stations. Maybe I'm dealing with a form of PTSD. I'm just coming to terms with, Tim.
You didn't like the soft rock, Dave?
Oh, my God.
No.
There were clouds in my coffee, clouds in my coffee, and you're so vain. I used to hear that song 2 billion times on the car rides to Alabama with my family, Tim. I hate being in a car today because of being in a car with my family, Tim.
Wow.
They would chain smoke and no windows down. Carly Simon blaring on the radio. Fleetwood Mac. Now you know why part of my hatred for Fleetwood Mac exists, Tim.
I guess. Wow. Did you at least get air conditioning, though, Dave?
No. I had Polish air conditioning.
Oh,
and I can say that because my dad is Polish.
I see.
You'd crack the window. Yeah. And this is, we had those little vent windows at the front.
Mm-hmm.
That's all they'd crack.
No.
Because, my parents were gluttons for punishment. So literally the safest place for me in the car without a seatbelt on was on the floor in those little pockets where you put your feet because the smoke would hang just above that.
Right, right.
Oh, so that's where I spent most of my time. So those are some of my memories, But that's just me, Tim. Let's get off of my hatred of car rides.
Right.
I thought I hated them.
Okay.
Our first story might take it to a whole another level.
All right.
A 13-year-old boy from Tennessee stabbed his 15-year-old brother in Florida, telling deputies, "I'd rather go to jail than spend 8 hours in the car with my sibling." Lieutenant Todd Watkins with the Okaloosa County Sheriff's Office told Fox News on Sunday that he responded to the scene the day before and said deputies arrested the 13-year-old after he said he stabbed his brother in the arm 3 times with a multi-tool.
Oh.
Watkins said the teen told deputies he did it because he was tired of his brother picking on him. The incident happened inside a car parked in a driveway in Crestview, which is about a 45-minute drive from Pensacola. That's what Watkins said. The stabbed brother then walked to the door of the home and called 911. Watkins said his brother was being questioned about the incident. He said he understood his rights and that he did not regret stabbing his sibling, who was teasing him. "I stabbed him, and I don't care about going back to jail.
Wow.
I'd rather be in jail than 8 hours in the car with him," according to the arrest report. The 13-year-old, who was charged with aggravated battery with a deadly weapon, was brought to juvenile detention. "We've had incidents with siblings, but not this young," Watkins told Fox News. "I've never dealt with them this young with a violent crime." Watkins said that the older brother did not say much to deputies at the time he was stabbed. Watkins said the 15-year-old was heard calling some of his friends to retaliate against his brother while he was in the back of the ambulance, apparently to no avail. Doctors treated the 15-year-old for 3 deep puncture wounds before releasing him from the hospital, Watkins said, adding that his treatment did not include surgery. The two brothers live in Clarksville, Tennessee, about an hour's drive from Nashville, Tim. So if you think that you couldn't get along with your siblings.
Actually, you know, we used to, my sister and I, we used to do this thing called the bunny show in the back of the station wagon where, you know, you put your little fingers like a bunny, and she put her little fingers like a bunny. We used to entertain drivers in the back of the station wagon where the two little bunnies would like bow, and then they'd kind of do this thing, and then they'd fight, and then they'd kind of bow to the little drivers. And we even had a little sign that said the bunny show. And
stop. You're making my heart hurt.
Yeah, I mean, we got along, you know.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, maybe they would have gotten along better if they would have had a mom like this, Tim.
Okay.
A mother was arrested. I know it's hard to believe, Tim, was arrested for letting her children ride in an inflatable pool on top of her vehicle. Right? At least she's not stabbing him in the arm. She just realized that instead of wasting time, 8 hours in a car with their children driving her nuts, she just let him sit on an inflatable pool on top of the car.
Did this take place in Florida or Alabama?
it's being reported from Fox 35 in Orlando, but the story appears to be coming out of Dixon, Illinois, Tim.
Really?
Yeah, according to the day, I guess Florida jumped on the story so they could be like, hey, we're not the only one with dumb people.
Ah, I see.
According to the Dixon Police Department, 49-year-old Jennifer A. Janice Yeager was arrested on Tuesday afternoon. The department received a complaint from a concerned citizen about an Audi passenger car driving with children inside of a pool on the roof of the vehicle. They said that officers searched the area and observed a white Audi Q5 driving with a blue inflatable pool on the roof, two juveniles inside of the pool. Believe it or not, a traffic stop was conducted on the vehicle. Officers said that they learned that Yeager drove into town to inflate the pool at a friend's house and had her two juvenile daughters ride inside of the empty pool in order to hold it down on the drive home, Tim. So there's some logic. Some logic to why. Oh, Yeager was arrested for two counts of endangering the health of or life of a child and two counts of reckless conduct. She was also cited for failure to secure a passenger of the age of 8 and under the age of 16. She was transported to the Dixon Police Department, where she was processed and released after posting bond. The Dixon Police Department said that all charges are merely an allegation and the defendant is presumed innocent until proven guilty.
Do you suppose it kind of went a little like this? There's a butt hanging out of her mouth and she's saying, OK, get into the pool over there and sit down in a pool and hang on to the luggage rack and just hold on.
What kind of accent are you perpetrating there?
It's supposed to be an Illinois accent. Oh. And hold on for dear life while I get home. And when we get home, we'll have a couple of sausages and everything will be all right.
I don't know. The accent's great, though.
Oh, thank you.
So, you know, here's the problem with the law, Tim.
Okay.
Here's the problem I see with the law. Okay, so the mother, no, she didn't secure the children necessarily, but she put them in the softest thing. I mean, if they're going to fly off the car, they're going to be in a soft, rubbery pool, Tim.
It doesn't work but like a UFO, Dave. It doesn't just land.
Oh, no. Oh, no. The law doesn't like that. So here's a guy, forward thinking, who does try to secure his kids, and he's paying for it too, Tim. We're going to the Ontario Provincial Police, made a unique traffic stop Tuesday. They pulled over a 22-year-old driver and issued a citation for not securing a child properly in the car. A two-year-old was found riding on top of a case of beer instead of a booster seat. The toddler was not hurt, but police say children that small must ride in a protective seat. In Canada, children under 40 pounds need car seats. Kids under 8-year-olds have to ride in a booster seat. And I guess it's never okay to be on the roof of a car in an inflatable pool, Tim. That's the world we're living in now.
I found the flaw in the logic of having the kid sit on the beer. The kid's got a hot ass. You want a cold ass if you want to sit on the beer. You got to keep the beer cold.
Yeah, that's a pretty good point to bring up.
Yeah.
Here's this case, Tim, that we haven't had in a while, but this is a case of swift justice. Swift justice. Swift justice.
Wow, that one hurt my ears. That was so sharp.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Carjacker beaten to death after stealing a car with small kids inside. We're going to Philadelphia, Tim, where a Philadelphia man was killed after police say he stole a car that had two small children inside. The incident happened on Thursday outside of a pizza restaurant. According to authorities, the mother went inside where her boyfriend worked. Police say she left the engine running with a 7-month-old and a 1-year-old and a 5-year-old inside the car. Moments later, police say a man got into the vehicle and drove away. The couple were able to catch up to the 54-year-old carjacker after he got stuck in traffic. He fled on foot about a half a block, and then the boyfriend caught up to him, and there was some sort of physical struggle. Philadelphia Police Chief Inspector Scott Small told WPVI, then other males from the neighborhood intervened and began punching and kicking the man who took the vehicle. The suspected carjacker was found unconscious by medics with severe head injuries. He was taken to a hospital where he was pronounced dead.
Oh!
Attorney's office will have to decide if the father will be charged in the case. The beating was reportedly captured on security video. Authorities are still searching for the other men involved.
You know what? You steal a car, you take your chances. That's the name of that tune.
I don't know though. maybe you just beat him a little bit, but that is swift justice right there.
Well, yeah.
So there's a new movie out, Tim. Called Crawl.
Yeah. I've seen the trailer for it. Yeah.
So I took the family to go see Crawl this weekend. It's the whole concept is bad weather strikes. this town starts flooding and alligators are afoot. You know, this girl goes to try to find her father and he's basically trapped in the basement by this huge alligator.
Mm-hmm.
And then they kind of are struggling for the rest of the movie to figure out how the hell to get out of this house before it floods.
Hmm.
So it was okay. It was entertaining to a degree.
Mm-hmm.
I would say I wasn't overly impressed with it. It was interesting, but I think the best alligator movie I've ever seen has still got to be Lake Placid.
Okay.
Right. Which is comedy gold. It's that kind of horror genre.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what they're billing this movie as, kind of horror. I guess it's horror in the same way that Jaws was horror.
I thought there was a line in the trailer that said this was the best movie of the summer.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I'm sure they got some drunk guy from Florida to say that. And then they put it on the movie poster. I'd give it, out of 5 stars, I'd give it 3 stars. Huh. But, you know, something red box, like when you're really bored.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And it's an interesting concept that in these bayou country areas, when bad flooding comes, this would be something you worry about. The other thing I thought was bizarre is they weren't worried about water moccasins.
Yeah.
Being underneath the house, snakes and all kinds of nastiness. Yeah. That wasn't a concern. Just alligators.
Hmm.
And I thought, well, what could be stupider than this? And then this story came to my attention, too.
Oh, right. OK.
Police are warning, don't flush your drugs down the toilet because it could create meth gators, which obviously is going to be the sequel to Crawl, Tim.
Of course.
A police department in Tennessee is warning residents not to flush illegal drugs down the toilet because they could end up being ingested by wild animals. The Loretto Police Department explained that when you flush drugs down the toilet,
mm-hmm.
they end up in retention ponds where the water is stored for processing before it's sent downstream.
Okay.
Now, our sewer guys take great pride in releasing water that is cleaner than what is in the creek, but they are not really prepared for meth. That's what the department wrote on Facebook. Ducks, geese, and other waterfowl frequent our treatment ponds, and we shudder to think about one all hyped up on meth might end up doing. They also caution that if discarded, methamphetamine manages to make it further downstream, it could be eaten by alligators, creating methigators, Tim. Meth gators in Shoal Creek and Tennessee River down in North Alabama. The department offered to help residents safely dispose of illegal drugs and reminded people they can dispose of prescription medication in specially marked containers at City Hall.
Gators meth riding the snake. Gators. Yeah. Gators riding the snake. Here's the flaw in the logic, Dave. Mm-hmm. You ever seen somebody with meth mouth?
No.
They ain't got no teeth.
Oh.
Yeah.
So then you just get gummed to death by an angry alligator.
You got it.
Yeah. Well, let's lighten the mood a little bit, Tim. The Flay is reporting for us from Holiday, Florida, with mm-hmm. this story. A woman was arrested for assault after throwing a sandwich at her boyfriend Thursday night. According to arrest affidavit, 35-year-old Stacy Chamberlain was charged with domestic battery after getting into an argument with her live-in boyfriend over their pets attacking each other. During the argument, Chamberlain threw a sandwich at her boyfriend. While attempting to clean up the mess, Chamberlain pushed the man, causing a scratch. Officials did not release any information on the type of sandwich used in the argument. Well, you know, if it's on that hard French rolls, Tim, I can understand.
Oh, you could break
a criminal
teeth.
Complaint.
Yeah, you could break a jaw. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah. So that's it. Oh, shoot. How did I miss this story? Since we were talking carjacking and insanity, Tim, we're going to go to Greenville, South Carolina. Police say a woman stole a vehicle after throwing a snake at the driver.
Oh,
crashed through barricades set up for pole vaulting exhibition in South Carolina. In a statement, Greenville police identified the suspect as 29-year-old Hilmary Moreno Barrios. They say she was hurt in Friday's crash, but released from the hospital Monday. Authorities say Moreno Barrios demanded a woman's keys and threw a live black snake at her.
Hmm.
They say she drove off with the stolen SUV with the snake still in it. That's some balls right there. Unless it's like her pet snake.
Yeah. Yeah.
She was just trying to freak somebody out.
I gotta know, if you're driving along, let's say you're driving along rush hour traffic and somebody pitched a snake into the front of your car, what is your first reaction?
I'm pretty sure it's to have my heart seize up and cease all form of living.
Do you just do a barrel roll right out of your vehicle and let it just continue down the highway?
Tim, I don't know what part of my heart would just cease moving. You don't understand. Listen, I don't know if you recall this, but it was, around 1989. You and I lived in the beautiful town of Winona, Minnesota. And my son wanted a kitten. So we were going to go get a kitten for him. And actually, this was, I think, closer to 1990, right? Might have been mid-90s, 91 in that range. I remember it well, Tim. It was like it was yesterday. It was definitely sometime between the 1980s and the 1990s that this took place. But we went to this house in Winona, and my son, excited, ran ahead of us. And I rounded the corner and froze in my tracks because what was stretched across the sidewalk, Tim?
It was a big snake.
Yeah. It was humongous, Tim. It was the size of my arm.
Mm-hmm.
And my son was approaching it, and I froze. Tim physically had to, hey, Cliff, come here, buddy. He backed my son up and then physically lifted and carried me away from this. You were my Wesley from The Princess Bride, Tim. That's what you were.
Aww.
You picked me up. You saved me. You fling a fucking snake in my car, game over. Game over, man. Game over. But as long as we're talking snakes and cars, Tim, tired of these fucking snakes and these fucking cars.
Yeah.
Police in Oklahoma stopped a vehicle that was reported as stolen on June 26th, and they found a rattlesnake, a canister of radioactive powdered uranium, and an open bottle of Kentucky Deluxe whiskey, according to the AP and KFOR, Tim.
That's a party right there.
Stephen Jennings was charged with possession of a stolen vehicle, transporting an open container of liquor, operating a vehicle with a suspended license, and failure to carry security verification form. His passenger, Rachel Rivera, was charged with possession of a firearm after a former felony conviction. The stop was made at around 11 a.m. for an expired tag. Good grief, the story jumped on me here. Jennings was in the driver's seat. Rivera was in the passenger seat. And their pet timber rattlesnake was sitting in the back seat in a terrarium.
That's not a pet.
Jennings told police he had a gun in the console right around the same time the vehicle was reported as stolen. Speaking about the vehicle's unusual inventory, a local police officer said, when that happens, of course, we call in a company that deals with specifically... I'm sorry, it's poorly written. When that happens, of course, we call in a company that deals with that specifically, and it's taken safely into possession. The uranium was the wild card in the situation. Now, oddly, there have been no charges stemming from the rattlesnake or the uranium thus far. It does happen to be rattlesnake season. So he can be in possession of his rattlesnake because he has a valid lifetime hunting and fishing license, the officer concluded. So this guy had open whiskey,
mm-hmm.
weapons,
yep.
in a stolen car,
mm-hmm.
with their pet rattlesnake, and powdered uranium. What kind of high is this guy going for, Tim?
The ultimate.
Powdered uranium?
The ultimate, Dave.
Oh, good God. And now, have you heard about this crime wave going on? Morons licking things and putting them back?
Yeah. It's disturbing.
It started with this dumbass woman who opened an ice cream container, licked it, and put it back.
Little Bluebell, yeah. Yeah.
Well, first of all, if I ever open up my ice cream and there's that plastic seal is not intact, I'm not buying it.
Right.
But... people are just ignorant jackasses. Mm-hmm. And then there's been other people that have now done it as well. Now, another guy, I guess, got arrested. And this one confuses me. He did the same thing, but then bought the ice cream.
Yeah, well, the original Bluebell girl licked it and bought it, I guess. But still,
I thought she put it back on the shelf. I thought that was the whole problem.
No, I guess she did buy it. I guess she licked it. And then when the camera shut off, she went up and bought it. But still... That doesn't excuse anything. You shouldn't even fake something like that.
Well, the Flay has a whole new story to share with us, Tim. Okay. WFLA from Tampa, Florida. A Florida mother was arrested after her daughter reportedly licked a tongue depressor at a doctor's office and put it back.
Oh, no.
Corey Ward was said she was just being silly when she recorded a video of her daughter inside of an exam room at the All About Kids and Family Medical Center in Jacksonville. The 10-year-old who was the patient can be seen putting the tongue depressor or pulling it out of a jar, licking it, and then placing it back into the same jar. Why do it and record it? I had just been waiting a long time. I was just being silly with my kids, Ward told WJXT, the Juxt, Tim. The video has since gone viral, and Ward said she started receiving death threats. It was later taken down. The video came amid a disturbing trend in which people are licking items and putting them back. But the mother told First Coast News that it wasn't a choreographed prank. What I didn't know was that there was a licking challenge, as I don't scroll social media like that, Ward said in a Facebook post before apparently deleting her profile. The video doesn't show that the items were thrown away or anything else that happened. Her explanation continued. I posted this on my personal Snapchat with my 20-something friends where someone allowed another person to video it. I didn't post it on Facebook or YouTube as a challenge or whatever. So I guess that makes the idiocy of the crime not as important, Tim. As long as nobody else knows you did a crime, I guess it's not a crime.
My God.
No, the facility released a statement saying, we immediately removed all materials and containers from the specific exam room and re-sanitized our entire facility. Ward 30 is charged with tampering with a consumer product without regard for possible death or bodily injury, which is a felony. She is being held without bond and is due in court Friday morning.
Nah, she should. Yeah, it's you can't do that. Come on.
People. People is dumb, Tim.
Very, very.
Florida man, Tim, he's back in the news. A Florida woman has warned parents to protect their children after an iguana hunter shot her pool maintenance technician, or as we like to call him, Pablo the pool boy. That happened Friday. Pool maintenance workers arrived at a property where E. Lynn Bryan lives in the coastal city of Boca Raton, southeastern Florida. At the same time, an iguana hunter armed with a pellet gun was patrolling the residence, NBC 6 South Florida reported. Bryan told the broadcaster she went outside to see what the workers were doing, recalling the moment she saw a man she described as her pool guy get shot. That's what she told the broadcaster. I heard him scream on the top of his lungs. Ow! And he had blood coming out of his leg. Bryan realized the pool worker had been struck by a man looking for iguanas who was shot by the hunter. According to the Florida Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission, green iguanas are considered pests as they damage sidewalks, seawalls, and landscape plants. Nevertheless, the Boca Raton resident urged others to be cautious when it comes to controlling the population. We have iguanas everywhere. If neighbors are going to be like the Wild West and shoot at everything, someone's going to get killed, she told NBC 6 South Florida. Bryan said her neighbors were horrified when he told them about the when she told them about the incident. Police said paramedics were called to the scene, according to the outlet. You need to protect your children. The kids fish back here all the time, warned Bryan. Stephen Kavishamavasky, a local trapping firm, Iguana Busters, which was not involved in the shooting, told Newsweek there is currently no certification process for iguana trappers, but there are restrictions on the use of high-powered PCP air rifles. As such, it's up to the individual or company to ensure that they are properly trained, he said. We are in the peak iguana season, and with more people taking matters into their own hands, it very easily could happen again. Kashavavamananashki explained his team wears clothing which makes it clear that they're hunters and hire ex-police and military personnel who are good shots. Before hiring a trapper, I would recommend checking their credentials to include their training. Also ask for their references. Ask if they're registered with the FWC and make sure that they have liability insurance. That's what was advised by Mr. Kavanashki, Tim.
I see, yeah.
The animals are considered to be such a nuisance in the state of Florida, Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission urges residents to kill them. On its website, the agency stressed the species is not protected in Florida other than by anti-cruelty laws. Wasn't shooting something cruel?
Well, it can be, yeah. Sometimes it's just putting something out of its misery. But
homeowners do not need a permit to kill iguanas on their property, said the FWC encourages homeowners to kill green iguanas on their own property whenever possible. Members of the public can also kill iguanas in 22 public lands in South Florida without a permit, including the fish-eating creek stream flowing into Lake Okeechobee. How do they just, people just get them, release them into the wild, and now they're running amok?
I guess so, yeah. They get tired of getting them high, and then they just release them out into Lake Okeechobee, I guess. Yeah.
Well, we've got a couple of rogue criminals, Tim, we're going to talk about next.
Okay.
Timothy Smith and his fiance thought it was odd when they pulled up to their Gresham home with relatives Sunday afternoon and spotted a McBrook Pro, a bottle of cider and knives atop their car. Yeah, that's strange. A McBrook, I said to him. It's a MacBook Pro.
Yeah, MacBook Pro. Yep.
Yeah. Yep. I call it a MacBook.
A MacBook. You get that at McDonald's?
A MacBook. Yeah. And not one of them iPhone people.
I see.
I'm a PC, so I see, old MacBook.
Yeah.
The old MacBook Pro, bottle of cider and knives atop their car. They brought the items inside thinking maybe they were misplaced by one of their friends or new neighbors. The couple had closed on their house about 2 weeks earlier and hosted a party on Saturday to celebrate their upcoming October wedding. They plan to finish moving in all their belongings later Saturday. Inside the home, Smith and his fiance noticed some of their things had been shifted around. They spotted a vape pen in their kitchen that wasn't theirs. Someone had taken off a central heating grate in the hallway and pulled out the filter. So then I grabbed two of the knives and I'm walking around looking for someone because clearly a person has broken in, Smith, 24, told the Oregonian. He found the master bedroom door locked. The couple used a key to get inside. They found no one, but the window was open. The screen was torn off and someone had apparently kicked a hole in the wall, burrowing into an adjacent bedroom. The couple found holes in the walls of that bedroom, too, and a mirror ripped off a nearby bathroom wall. Smith's hats filled the bathtub, and a stranger's clothes sat atop the washing machine. Smith saw that a hatch to the crawl space inside a third bedroom was open, so he went down there with knives, Tim. He crawled through the roughly 3 feet tall space and yelled for anyone inside to announce themselves. Smith said he crawled about halfway through the space when he saw a cat wearing a green cashmere sleeveless shirt belonging to one of his chihuahuas staring back at him. This is getting really surreal and bizarre.
This is some good weed.
First of all, how brave are you? Like, see, here's the one thing, Tim. I don't like enclosed spaces either.
Yeah.
I go into them. But how brave are you to think that you're going to crawl under the house in this 3 foot tall area with a knife and think you're going to find an intruder and go to war with them down there?
Yeah, that you, when you're in tight spaces, you can't fight very well.
No.
Yeah.
No. And then to find a cat wearing a sleeveless cashmere sweatshirt that belongs to a chihuahua. No one leaves a dressed cat in a crawl space unless they're coming back or they're still here, Smith said. So I got out and shut the door. Smith, his fiance, and relatives retreated outside, called 911. About 15 minutes later, Smith said they heard what sounded like handcuffs tightening and saw officers leading a man out the front door. The stranger was wearing Smith's fiance's hooded onesie adorned with hearts and snowflakes.
Aww.
We were livid, Smith said. Our sanctuary was destroyed by someone who had no business being there. And he's wearing my fiance's clothes. There's just no reason for it. Well, sure there was. His clothes were dirty.
Well, yeah.
You didn't want him walking around sitting naked on your furniture, did you?
No.
Smith said the couple spent a year looking for their first home together and 3 months purchasing the Gresham home. They had almost finished moving in when they were burglarized. Over the 3 hours the home was left unoccupied Sunday, Smith said the man broke in through the bedroom window, went through the walls, made himself coffee, ate a cupcake, drank a beer, smoked their marijuana, and played video games in the garage. Needles were on the ground in the garage that police said had methamphetamine inside. The man, later identified by police as 38-year-old Ryan Bishop, at some point took yarn that Smith's fiance's aunt bought to make a quilt for the couple into the crawlspace with him, tied one end to the bottom of the crawlspace entrance and another where he was hiding in an apparent attempt to be alerted if anyone came into the crawlspace, Smith said. I don't hate this guy. And I guess if there's anything I hope people take away from this is that if you're looking for help, then seek it, because there's nothing else you can do for yourself in that situation. He said, I've been in your shoes. 4 years ago, I was an addict in Raleigh, North Carolina. Today, I'm clean and a homeowner, but it doesn't happen without seeking help. Bishop remains held Monday in the Multnomah County Detention Center, Tim. That is the Multnomah County Detention Center, on accusations of first-degree burglary and first-degree criminal mischief. I'd say accusations, it's beyond that. Smith said he wasn't sure where the items or the car or the cat, who police said Bishop named Spaghetti, came from. The cat initially refused to leave the crawl space, but has since come out. Smith said the feline is staying with him and his fiance as they try to determine if anyone in the area had their cat stolen. Smith said the couple owns four other cats, two dogs, and a snake, and can't take on another pet.
No doubt.
A cute one named Spaghetti, Tim.
You know, if the guy ever gets clean, he's quite industrious. I mean, in three hours, he got a lot of stuff done.
Yeah, he did.
Yeah, he did. He's got a future.
Well, it's all meth, right? Doesn't that keep you bouncing?
It does, yeah. It keeps you going. But I think 5-hour energy would do the same thing for him.
This guy, in the next story, Tim, he wasn't, you know, it wasn't a piece of yarn stretched across the basement that got him caught.
Really?
Yeah, we're going to Liberty, Missouri, Tim. A person in Missouri tried their very best to hide from law enforcement. Well, that is until he farted very loudly. According to the Clay County Sheriff's Office, I hate being a nervous farter. According to the Clay County Sheriff's Office Facebook post, a video was posted of the search. Authorities added that while officials were looking for an individual wanted on a drug charge, the person farted loudly, so loudly that deputies were able to locate the suspect's hiding place. If you've got a felony warrant for your arrest, the cops are looking for you, and you pass gas so loud it gives up your hiding spot, you're definitely going to have a shit day, the post said. We've got to give props to the Liberty Police Department for using their senses to sniff him out, the sheriff's office wrote in the comments. The person was arrested for possession of a controlled substance.
Can you just imagine? Oh, I guess we lost him. Nope. Right over there.
Yeah. Well, as long as we're talking weird drug addicts and people on the run from the law, Tim, let's go to Wisconsin, shall we?
Sure.
A Wisconsin man was arrested last week after he allegedly was caught running around naked while claiming to be on tons of acid. That's in quotations. Benjamin Snap, 29, was arrested on June 29th after he was found running around a parking lot yelling incoherently. How is that any different than most Wisconsinites? Authorities found Snap in a parking lot where they said he appeared to be under the influence of drugs. Hmm. When the man was asked why he was running around naked, he allegedly told police officers, "You already know, man. There's nothing wrong with this man. Oh, that's what's all this. That's what drugs are for, man." That's what he said here. Are you really going to make a big effing deal out of this? Snap asked police, according to the news outlet. He allegedly said he took a lot of drugs and questioned what's wrong with being a heroin addict. Absolutely nothing. Naked guy running around. Snap then allegedly confessed on being on tons and tons and tons and tons of acid. I kid you not, that's how it's reported. Tons and tons and tons and tons and tons of acid. The 29-year-old was arrested for lewd and lascivious behavior and disorderly conduct.
Way to go, kid. Your future's
keeping
bright.
It classy.
Yep.
Yeah.
Future's bright.
What the living hell is this story? A man has been arrested after someone dressed in a gimp suit jumped out on a woman in Somerset Village. Someone was charging at me in a full black rubbery suit, the woman who had been walking in Claverham said. Police said a man in his 20s had been arrested on suspicion of indecency offenses in Claverham and Yatton. It follows 14 reports of man approaching people while wearing disguises, one of which was a black rubber bodysuit.
I really got to find something better to do with my weekends.
Yeah, obviously. However, despite using a helicopter and a sniffer dog, they were unable to find the man in the gimp suit, who the woman said had advanced toward her grunting and breathing heavily before fleeing. Do you think he was grunting and breathing heavily because he was in a black rubber gimp suit and may have farted accidentally?
That could do it. Yeah, yeah.
He was just looking for her to help get him out of the costume.
It's amazing what happens when you're breathing in your own brand for a long time, you know?
God. All right, our final two stories. Cops say it's man bites dog, literally, Tim. A New Hampshire man who allegedly growled at and bit a police canine was arrested Friday. Officers from the Manchester Police Department were called after Matthew Williams, 35, of Nashua, was reported to be behaving erratically, as opposed to erotically, in a hotel room. Yeah. Tim, investigators said Williams wouldn't respond to their calls to leave the room or answer his phone, and instead yelling, throwing items, and acting aggressive. Soon a New Hampshire State Police canine team was called to the scene, but when the dog entered the hotel room, Williams allegedly wrapped his arms around the dog, struggled with him, and at one point Williams growled, opened his mouth, and bit the dog on the top of the head.
Jeez.
Williams was charged with resisting arrest, simple assault, and willful interference with police dogs. Authorities said the dog wasn't hurt in the incident. What? Our final story, Tim, is here and upon us. We're going to Milledgeville. I don't know how the hell you say this. Milledgeville, Georgia. Milledgeville. Milledgeville, Georgia. If Moana and marijuana sound the same to you, you're not alone. A Georgia woman Facebook post is going viral after posting about a hilarious birthday cake mix-up, Tim. Kensley Taylor Davis says that her mom ordered a cake from a local baker for her upcoming 25th birthday party. Her mother told the baker how much Kensley loved Disney's Moana and wanted a cake themed around the character.
Oh.
When her mother went to pick up the cake, she found a marijuana-themed birthday surprise. So my mama called and ordered me a cake telling them how much I loved Moana, because I really do. Well, needless to say, these people thought she said marijuana. The baker reportedly misheard the mother and decorated Kensley's cake with a cannabis leaf and a My Little Pony character that appeared to be stoned and smoking a joint. To complete the look, the pony also appeared to have red eyes and a pot leaf tattoo on his side. Sweet. We weren't mad about it or anything. We thought it was funny, so we ate it anyway. That's what Kensley told Fox 35. Kensley said, "That was the best cake ever.
I want that cake for my birthday."
Here's the deal. For your 25th birthday, you want a Moana cake and your mama has to order it for you?
Well,
mama, I want a Moana cake.
Some people's cakes.
The cake is great, Tim. I'm not going to lie.
Yeah.
I'm going to shoot that over to you. People, you have to look it up yourself, because I'm not your damn mom. I don't have to give you all the stories. Go look them up. But Tim, if you're wanting to see the cake,
I am. Yeah.
I'd like you to enjoy that photograph of today's cake.
I am all that is sweet. I am getting
that. Is it not? Which is that? My Little Stony Pony?
My Little Stony Pony. I'm getting that for my birthday.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I know what to order for you. That's it for this week. We will be back next week, and we're going to be on the hunt, Tim, for the American Predator. The hunt for the most meticulous serial killer of the 21st century. Maureen Callahan, our guest, when we return to the best in True Crime Talk Radio next week, right here on True Crime Tuesday.